You can ask her for anything, to bless a shipment of crystal meth, for example. Santa Muerte was featured in the first scene of season 3 of Breaking Bad when a sketch of Heisenberg was pinned to her statue. In the last 10 years, the growth of the cult has been meteoric. The skeleton saint, also known as the bony lady or skinny girl, now has some 10 to 12 million devotees who pray to her on Facebook and leave cigars, shots of rum, Barbie dolls, and ashtrays as offerings at her shrines. NBC recently covered her presence in Miami, and in Houston, a grassroots movement works to raise money to build her a permanent church. Santa Muerte is just one of many narco saints. Another, especially popular in northern Mexico and southern California, is the legendary bandit Jesus Malverde, also known as the Angel of the Poor, or the Saint of the Drug Dealers. Malverde was also featured on Breaking Bad, in the form of a bust on a DEA agent's desk in a season 2 episode. Malverde's cult is based in Mexico's northwestern coastal state of Sinaloa, home to the powerful Sinaloa drug cartel, which engineered the prison escape of drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The destination of hundreds of pilgrims each year, Malverde's shrine in the capital city of Culiacan is filled with photos and plaques. Inscriptions include, "Thank you, Malverde, for saving me from drugs," and "Thank you, Malverde, for not having to lose my arm and leg." There are also desperate letters, like this one from Los Angeles. "Dear holy and miraculous Malverde, I'm writing this letter so that you'll help me with a problem I have with some friends I had, so that they won't look for me anymore. Make them forget the problems we had. Make them please leave my parents and my sister and me in peace." Narco-saint cults may strike elites as irrational or ridiculous, but they respond to the distinctive plight and marginalized status of the less well-off, offering them a group affiliation responsive to their needs and sense of exclusion. In the words of a Mexican-American lawyer, "Most Mexican-Americans today live in deep social isolation. I'm talking about the overwhelming majority, those with poor education, poor housing, poor wages. There's a clear distrust of U.S. politics, a perception that only a few control the country, with the rest of Americans being used as labor." Narco-saint cults are not dangerous in the way that the sovereign citizens or street gangs are, but they are dangerous in another way. They testify to the growing number of alienated poor Americans who are retreating into ethnically insular communities with little sense of connection to the country's institutions or its civic life. The have-not groups discussed so far are outside mainstream American culture. They are so illicit or socially marginal that they have virtually no political influence. But other groups popular with lower-income Americans are very different. Some of them may be equally unknown to America's elites, but they are much more politically salient, indeed closely related to the rise of Donald Trump. The Prosperity Gospel. There are 65 megachurches in America with more than 10,000 weekly attendees, and almost half of these preach the prosperity gospel. The average prosperity church has 8,500 members. The celebrity pastor, Joel Osteen, has a congregation of 35,000 at the Lakewood Church in Houston and draws 7 million viewers weekly to his televised sermons. Not far behind, the African-American televangelist Creflo Dollar preaches to 30,000 at the World Changers Church he founded in Georgia. While most elites have never heard of the prosperity gospel, Donald Trump used it to his advantage. On the 2016 campaign trail, prosperity gospel televangelist Mark Burns praised Trump and introduced him with these rousing words, a strange twist on Barack Obama's. "There is no black person, there is no white person, there is no yellow person, there is no red person, there's only green people. Green is money. Green are jobs." The prosperity gospel, which is Christian but cuts across denominations, preaches that being rich is divine. Given that Jesus said, according to the Gospel of Matthew, "You cannot serve both God and money," and "It is easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God," the theological underpinnings of the prosperity gospel are a little murky, but prosperity preachers have been quite creative. According to some, despite appearances, Jesus himself was rich. As evidence, they point to the circumstances of his birth. "As soon as Jesus arrived," noted Dollar, who owns two Rolls Royces and a private jet, "the anointing to prosper acted like a magnet, drawing wise men with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Those were not cheap gifts. Prosperity attached itself to baby Jesus immediately, and that same gift to prosper has been given to us as heirs of Christ." Similarly, on the popular Believer's Voice of Victory television show, prosperity author John Avanzini observed that Jesus had a nice house, big enough to have company stay the night with him, and wore designer clothes. "You didn't get the stuff he wore off the rack. This was custom stuff." Other prosperity movement leaders focus on the Old Testament. According to Deuteronomy, explained the influential prosperity pastor Kenneth Hagin, poverty was a punishment God brought on people if they disobeyed him. After all, in the Garden of Eden, God surrounded Adam and Eve with every material blessing they could possibly need. After the fall, it was Satan who inflicted misery on mankind. Jesus's death and resurrection redeemed humanity not just from sin, but from disease and poverty as well. As the African-American pastor Leroy Thompson explained, "He took your place in poverty so you could take his place in prosperity." One of the most distinctive features of prosperity services is openly praying for money. In her book Blessed, Kate Bowler describes a Sunday service at the Victorious Faith Center, an African-American church in North Carolina. It was normally the pastor who riveted the crowd with his fiery sermons, but on this occasion, his wife rose unexpectedly from her seat in the front row and faced the congregation. "Faith requires action," she declared with surprising volume. Her small figure seemed to grow as the room got more excited. "Money," she shouted, the congregation calling out with her. "Cometh unto me." She paused in anticipation. "Now." With that, the First Lady began to dance. Some 80 believers, young and old, threw off their inhibitions and joined her. The murmur rose to a din as people began to call out their needs. Tears streamed down as people remembered what they desired or the losses that they hoped to replace. "Money cometh unto me now," voices called again. With its blatant emphasis on getting rich, the prosperity gospel has many detractors. Few of its followers attend elite universities in the Northeast, where one is much more likely to find the children of millionaires claiming to be deeply anti-materialistic. But the prosperity gospel holds enormous appeal for have-nots and have-lesses, and it is especially popular with disadvantaged minorities. For the struggling, the prosperity gospel offers hope, direction, and a community of similarly situated peers. Unlike the unrepresentative anti-inequality protest groups, At the same time, it offers the less well-off a more dignified self-image. As Bowler puts it, the teachings of the prosperity gospel lift believers' chins and square their shoulders. Osteen preaches that his congregants are not victims, but victors. Creflo Dollar teaches that even the poor control their own destinies. Rather than thinking of themselves as society's oppressed, or as part of the 99%, or even simply as have-nots, prosperity adherents see themselves as the favored, the optimistic, the blessed. NASCAR Nation. Sports are always tribal. But whereas football, baseball, and basketball are popular across the social spectrum, NASCAR, with 75 million fans, the second most attended sport after the NFL, takes open pride in its white, working-class origins. According to NASCAR lore, stock car racing was started by Appalachian moonshiners trying to transport bootleg whiskey while evading law enforcement. Although the demographics of its fan base are rapidly evolving, today 40% of NASCAR fans are women, the NASCAR Nation holds tightly to its image as stereotypically white, masculine, southern, and rural. Its fan base remains overwhelmingly Republican, and racing speak is filled with macho idioms like, "If it ain't rubbin', it ain't racin'," "Gentlemen, let's get it on," "Boys, have at it," and, of course, "Gentlemen, start your engines." NASCAR is all about tribalism. Fans are loyal not just to a manufacturer, Chevrolet, Ford, Dodge, or Toyota, and a driver, but also to their corporate sponsors, which include big names like Goodyear, Home Depot, McDonald's, Geico, Miller, Mountain Dew, and Burger King. A recent study showed that NASCAR fans are more brand loyal than the fans of any other sport, and that they feel they are contributing to their team when they buy sponsored products. "I have an Interstate battery in three of my vehicles that I own now," said one NASCAR fan. "Got to drink Budweiser. If you ain't drinking Budweiser, you don't belong here." Fans are three times more likely to buy a product sponsored by their NASCAR team than an unsponsored product, and this applies to everything from cell phones to breakfast foods. "I have a Nextel phone, so you know I'm a big supporter. I use Tide," said one fan. "Anything you see out there, I'm using. I eat Cheerios." Fan devotion to NASCAR is so intense that it's often compared to a religion. Sociologists who have studied stock car culture in America refer to the NASCAR congregation worshiping the gospel of NASCAR and the pilgrimages that fans make, arriving in their RVs the Friday before the race and staying through the weekend. An important theme, concluded one researcher, summarizing numerous fan interviews, was that of belonging. Part of the group experience of NASCAR is the sheer physical intensity of attending a stadium event with a quarter of a million other human beings roaring for their drivers as cars hurtle by at more than 200 miles per hour. "You can't even hear yourself think," one fan put it. That's why NASCAR's slogan is, "Feel the thunder. If you haven't been there, you can't understand." The fans scream at one another above the roar, some of them screaming in pure joy. At the moment, NASCAR is struggling with its group identity. Its wealthy owner and CEO, Brian France, has been trying to broaden the NASCAR base by reaching out to women and minorities, as well as wealthier Americans. Nevertheless, at NASCAR races, there continues to be a proud assertion of a distinctive regional and cultural identity. Indeed, at the Daytona International Speedway in June 2015, NASCAR fans defied a request not to fly Confederate flags after the Charleston Church massacre. Spotting a Confederate flag was easier than finding a souvenir shop, restroom, or beer stand, Fox News reported. My family is from Alabama, and we've been going to Talladega forever, explained a fan. It isn't a Confederate thing so much as a NASCAR thing. That's why I fly it. At the same time, NASCAR events are extremely patriotic, with American flags waving and proclamations about the greatest nation on earth. Of course, it's precisely the merging of these two identities that makes the NASCAR experience so appealing to some and so repugnant to others. The idea that NASCAR's America is the true America. World Wrestling Entertainment, WWE, and the Trump Phenomenon. Like adherents of the prosperity gospel, the NASCAR nation tends to love Donald Trump and see in him the America they stand for. Indeed, Brian France endorsed him for president. But the sport most illuminating of Trump's startling political success and of the class dimension behind that phenomenon is not NASCAR. It's professional wrestling. WWE is perhaps the single best example of the cultural divide between America's haves and have-nots. For elites, WWE is so unfathomably alien and appalling, gaudy, fake, bombastic, violent, and hyper-masculine, it's not just an object of ridicule, but the subject of voyeuristic academic study. When Roland Barthes, a darling of post-structuralism and famed scholar of semiotics, wrote about the world of wrestling in his landmark work Mythologies, he launched a cottage academic industry devoted to analyzing, in increasingly abstruse terms, the appeal and meaning of professional wrestling. Left intellectuals are fascinated, even obsessed in a horrified way, with the phenomenology of watching professional wrestling. Do working-class Americans understand they are watching something fake? Do they simply suspend disbelief? Or is it possible that some of them are duped into thinking they are watching an actual contest? Cultural theorists have written about how professional wrestling elides the distinction between real and fictive, how it performs narratives about modern romance, how it represents a modern form of melodrama, how it allows lower and working class viewers to play out the drama of good versus evil, might versus right. In contrast to speculating about the phenomenon of professional wrestling, Donald Trump actually has participated. He once entered the ring, taking on WWE founder Vince McMahon in a mock showdown that ended in a victorious Trump shaving McMahon's head, an exhibition that, in one Huffington Post writer's words, was both mesmerizing and gross. Trump is in the WWE Hall of Fame, inducted in 2013, and is listed on its website as a WWE superstar. Trump's connection to wrestling did not end when he won the White House. Among President Trump's first cabinet-level nominees was the former CEO of WWE and wife of its founder, Linda McMahon, whom he chose to head the Small Business Administration. And far from being abashed by his own time in the ring, in July 2017, Trump proudly tweeted a video clip from the McMahon match, showing himself pummeling a figure with a CNN logo superimposed on its head. The parallels between the Trump phenomenon and WWE are unmistakable. Although WWE has a significant Black and Latino working class following as well, the prototypical WWE fan is white, male, single, working class, and, according to some experts, disaffected. Geographically, professional wrestling is especially popular in America's former industrial heartland and the South, and has practically no fan base in multicultural California. It's no surprise, then, that the WWE audience resembles the coalition of voters who buoyed Trump's candidacy. Nor is it a coincidence that coastal elites, including the media, find Trump and WWE equally repulsive. In a New York Times op-ed, Gail Collins described Linda McMahon as a political novice who made her fortune building up an entertainment business that specialized in blood, semi-naked women, and scripted subplots featuring rape, adultery, and familial violence, and whose family yacht is named Sexy Bitch. By contrast, Trump said of his cabinet pick, "Linda has a tremendous background and is widely recognized as one of the country's top female executives advising businesses around the globe." To understand Trump's relationship to the WWE and his appeal to its audience is to see a microcosm of the 2016 election. For Trump's supporters, as in WrestleMania, showmanship and symbols are often what matter. Where progressives saw an uncivilized brute bloviating about his sexual prowess, lying on cue, and viciously dressing down his opponents, Trump's supporters saw something familiar and playfully spectacular. In Trump's world, as in the wrestling world, absurd, alternative facts are not falsehoods, but storylines fueling an entertainment-driven narrative. Through this lens, Trump is a hero in the mold of Hulk Hogan or Stone Cold Steve Austin, a domineering titan promising to vanquish the forces of evil, to crusade against political correctness, to make aggressive masculinity fashionable again. Riffing off political analyst Selena Zito's famous statement that the press took Trump literally but not seriously, whereas his supporters took him seriously but not literally, Trump donor and briefly White House communications director Anthony Scaramucci put it this way: "Don't take him literally, take him symbolically." America's two white tribes. To many on the left, anyone who even mentions economic factors as having contributed to Trump's election is either racist or, at a minimum, perpetuating and enabling racism. As a Vox article put it, "As this election fades into the distance, we'll spin a collective fairy tale about how a neglected group of white Americans who themselves were victims simply wanted change and used their votes to demand it. There will be a push to understand them, and this will be presented as the mature and moral thing to do. And when that happens, when the deep bigotry that fueled the result is forgotten or explained away, racism will win yet again." But to see the divisiveness in today's America and the forces that brought about Trump's election as solely about racism, while ignoring the role of inequality, misses too much of the picture. Even putting economics aside, it misses the role played by white against white resentment and antagonism. Consider the following from a 2016 National Review op-ed about the white working class. "Nobody did this to them. They failed themselves. Take an honest look at the welfare dependency, the drug and alcohol addiction, the family anarchy, which is to say, the whelping of human children with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog, and you will come to an awful realization. Nothing happened to them. There wasn't a war or a famine. Even the economic changes of the past few decades do very little to explain the dysfunction and negligence and the incomprehensible malice of poor white America. The truth about these dysfunctional, downscale communities is that they deserve to die. Economically, they are negative assets. Morally, they are indefensible. The white American underclass is in thrall to a vicious, selfish culture whose main products are misery and used heroin needles. Especially in our age of political correctness, it's hard to imagine this kind of language being applied to any other group. The truth is that white Americans often hold their biggest disdain for other white Americans, the ones on the opposite side of the cultural divide. In January 2017, Silicon Valley executive Melinda Byerly created a stir when she tweeted out her explanation for why we, referring to people like herself, who won't sacrifice tolerance or diversity, don't want to live in middle America. No educated person wants to live in a shithole with stupid people, especially violent, racist, and/or misogynistic ones. The antipathy and disdain are mutual. Trump supporters in the country's heartland see liberals as smug, elitist, hypocritical, condescending, and pampered. Many genuinely believe that liberals hate America. The number one New York Times best-selling author, Ann Coulter, has accused liberals of treason. In her words, liberals hate America. They hate flag wavers. They hate abortion opponents. They hate all religious groups except Islam, post-9/11. Even Islamic terrorists don't hate America like liberals do. In other words, white America is itself divided. Indeed, there is now so little interaction, commonality, and intermarriage between rural/heartland/working-class whites and urban/coastal whites that the difference between them is practically what social scientists would consider an ethnic difference. They think of themselves as belonging to distinct and opposing political tribes. As Appalachian writer J.D. Vance puts it in Hillbilly Elegy, "I may be white, but I do not identify with the WASPs of the Northeast. Instead, I identify with the millions of working-class white Americans of Scots-Irish descent who have no college degree, whose ancestors were day laborers in the southern slave economy, sharecroppers after that, coal miners after that." Tribalism in America propelled Donald Trump to the White House. If we want to understand this tribalism, we have to acknowledge the impact of inequality and the wedge it has driven between America's whites. Coastal elites have become a kind of market-dominant minority from the point of view of America's heartland. And, as we've seen all over the developing world, market-dominant minorities invariably end up producing democratic backlash. Chapter 8. Democracy and Political Tribalism in America. There is nothing which I dread so much as the division of the Republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader and concerting measures in opposition to each other. This, in my humble apprehension, is to be dreaded as the greatest political evil under our Constitution. John Adams, Letter to Jonathan Jackson, 1780. America is woven of many strands. I would recognize them and let it so remain. Our fate is to become one and yet many. This is not prophecy, but description. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man. At the core of American political tribalism, however, is race. This has always been true, but the present moment is especially fraught. We are on the verge of an unprecedented demographic transformation, which will place intense strain on the social fabric. America is a supergroup, the only one among the major powers of the world. We have forged a national identity that transcends tribal politics, an identity that does not belong to any subgroup, that is strong and capacious enough to hold together an incredibly diverse population, making us all American. This status was hard won. It is precious. The destructive, fracturing tribalism that is seizing American politics puts this in jeopardy. The United States is in no immediate danger of actually breaking up, unlike the United Kingdom and the European Union. But America is in danger of losing something even more important: who we are. The left believes that right-wing tribalism, bigotry, racism, is tearing the country apart. The right believes that left-wing tribalism, identity politics, political correctness, is tearing the country apart. They are both right. The Browning of America. For the first time in U.S. history, white Americans are about to lose their status as the country's majority. In 1965, whites were still a dominant majority in America, 84%, with the rest of the populace mostly African American. But since then, there has been an immigration explosion. Over the last 50 years, nearly 59 million immigrants have arrived in the United States, legally or illegally, the largest wave of immigration in U.S. history. Unlike previous waves, these immigrants have been largely from Asia and Latin America. Between 1965 and 2015, the Asian population in America grew exponentially, from 1.3 million to 18 million, as did the Hispanic population, from 8 million to almost 57 million. As a result, the complexion of America is browning. Already, non-Hispanic whites are a minority in America's two most populous states, Texas and California. They are also a minority in New Mexico, Hawaii, Washington, D.C., and hundreds of counties across the country. By 2020, more than half of all American children under the age of 18 are expected to be non-white. According to Pew Foundation projections, whites will cease to be a majority in America by 2055. The U.S. Census predicts that this will happen by 2044. To be sure, the browning of America is not set in stone. The current projections for when America will become majority-minority depend on certain assumptions that may not hold. For example, the census typically categorizes multiracial, multi-ethnic children as minority, but many of them might self-identify as white. And with Asians outpacing Hispanics as the largest group of new immigrants, perhaps browning is already outdated, and beiging is more apt, raising different fears, connotations, and dynamics. The fact remains, it's going to happen. Whether in 2044, 2055, or later, non-Hispanic whites, as we understand the term, will cease to be a majority in America for the first time. How whites in America feel about this is extremely hard to measure. To begin with, some white Americans, especially in the country's many multicultural pockets, may genuinely welcome America's changing complexion. In 1998, President Bill Clinton said the following in a speech at Portland State University. "In a little more than 50 years, there will be no majority race in the United States. No other nation in history has gone through demographic change of this magnitude in so short a time. New immigrants are energizing our culture and broadening our vision of the world. They are renewing our most basic values and reminding us all of what it truly means to be an American. Many activists and academics would go much further and agree with the radical, white historian Noel Ignatieff that there is nothing positive about white identity, or that the browning of America is a long overdue corrective to what activist author William Wimsatt calls the sickness of race in America. But if there's one axiom of political tribalism, it's that dominant groups do not give up their power easily, and America is unlikely to be an exception. Indeed, U.S. history offers sobering evidence. While a white minority in America is unprecedented at the national level, it's not at the state level. After the Civil War, newly emancipated blacks suddenly eclipsed whites in the voting population in a number of southern states, including Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina. In all these states, whites were terrified by the prospect of black majority rule. With blacks in a large majority, southern politicians warned, "We will have black governors, black legislatures, black juries, black everything. We will be completely exterminated, and the land will go back into a wilderness and become another Africa or Saint Domingo." Southern whites responded to this threat by ushering in the period known as Jim Crow. There were even, as late as the 20th century, delegations from the American South to South Africa to learn tips on how to disenfranchise and subjugate a black majority. Through property and literacy qualifications, poll taxes, racially motivated redistricting, intimidation, and outright lynching, all the southern states were highly successful in preventing blacks from exercising the suffrage. In Louisiana, for example, the number of registered black voters fell from 130,334 in 1896 to only 1,342 in 1904. Of course, that was a long time ago, in an America that might seem gone with the wind, before Brown v. Board of Education, before the Civil Rights Act of 1964, before the Voting Rights Act of 1965, before affirmative action, before the appointment of America's first black Supreme Court justice, before the rise of political correctness, before the election of America's first African-American president. But such progress can be a two-edged sword. Many believe that the gains and successes of blacks make some whites, especially lower-income whites, feel threatened. White lash. It may seem absurd to some, but two-thirds of white working-class Americans feel that discrimination against whites is as big a problem today as discrimination against blacks and other minorities. Interestingly, 29% of black Americans agreed with this statement. Indeed, a significant number of white Americans believe that there is more racism against them than there is against black Americans, even though, by nearly any metric, statistics continue to indicate drastically poorer outcomes for black than white Americans. Strong evidence suggests that white anxiety about being displaced, being outnumbered, being discriminated against, has fueled recent conservative populist politics in America. Stanford sociologist Rob Willer and his colleagues conducted a series of survey-based experiments to test the decline of whiteness as an explanation for the rise of the Tea Party. In one experiment, Willer found that white survey participants shown a picture of President Obama with an artificially darkened skin tone were more likely to report they support the Tea Party than those shown a picture with Obama's skin tone artificially lightened. In another experiment, Willer found that participants who were told whites remain the largest ethnic group in the U.S. were less likely to report their support for the Tea Party than those who were told minorities are expected to surpass whites in number by 2042. According to numerous studies, similar dynamics fueled the 2016 presidential election. A Wall Street Journal analysis found that Donald Trump had especially strong support in counties most unsettled by rapid demographic change, i.e., by the recent influx of non-white immigrants into previously heavily white populations in small-town Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. A post-election survey by the Public Religion Research Institute, which was reported in The Atlantic, found that 52% of Trump voters said that they feel like the country has changed so much they often feel like strangers in their own land. White anxiety about anti-white discrimination cuts across party lines. According to a 2016 Pew study, about half of Republicans believe there is a lot or some discrimination against whites, but so do nearly 30% of Democrats. Even so, a striking YouGov/Huffington Post survey conducted in December 2016 found that Trump voters were 5 times more likely to believe that average Americans, a term psychological research has shown is implicitly synonymous with white Americans, aren't getting their fair share in society than they were to believe that blacks aren't getting their fair share. Indeed, according to political scientist Michael Tesler, perceptions that whites are currently treated unfairly relative to minorities appear to be an unusually strong predictor of support for Donald Trump in the general election. There is, in fact, some justification for these feelings of white marginalization, at least among a certain segment of the white population. Poor and working-class whites have among the highest rates of unemployment and addiction. Life expectancy is declining for whites without a high school degree, something true of almost no other demographic, including high school dropouts from other racial groups. Educational prospects for poor white children are extremely bleak. Private tutors and $1,000 SAT courses are completely cost-prohibitive to poor or even working-class people, and poor whites don't benefit from affirmative action. Whereas most elite colleges do special outreach for racial minorities, they rarely send scouts to the backwoods of Kentucky. Out of roughly 200 students in the Yale Law School class of 2019, there appears to be exactly one poor white, or three if we include students from families living just above the federal poverty line. Administrators have described this class as the most diverse in the school's history. It is simply a fact that the diversity policies at the most select American universities and in some sectors of the economy have had a disparate, adverse impact on whites. Relative to their population percentage, working-class whites, and particularly white Christians from conservative states, are often the most underrepresented group at America's elite universities. White employees increasingly feel victimized by pro-diversity promotion policies that they see as discriminating against them, and the United States Supreme Court has agreed, striking down as illegal a particularly bald-faced attempt by the city of New Haven, Connecticut, to invalidate promotions for white firefighters in order to promote more minorities. While whites generally are still extremely disproportionately represented in the U.S. Senate, the media, and the corporate world, working-class whites are decidedly not. Between 1999 and 2008, Only 13 of the 783 members of Congress who served had spent more than a quarter of their adulthood in blue-collar jobs. As political scientist Nick Carnes writes, although women and racial minorities were still underrepresented at the end of the 20th century, their gains during the post-war period sharply contrasted with the stable underrepresentation of working-class people, who made up between 50% and 60% of the nation during the last 100 years, but who constituted 2% or less of the legislators who served in each Congress during that time. The result of all this is that working-class whites have among the lowest upward mobility rates in the nation. Not surprisingly, when surveyed about the prospects of children today, whites were overwhelmingly more pessimistic than Latinos and blacks. Just 24% of whites believed the next generation would be better off financially or the same as their parents, compared to 49% of blacks and 62% of Latinos. Beyond their economic anxiety, many whites feel an intense cultural anxiety. America's culture wars are nothing if not a fight for the right to define our national identity, and it's a bitter, race-inflected battle. After Beyoncé channeled Black Lives Matter at the 2016 Super Bowl, half the country deified her, while the other half accused her of cop-killer entertainment. At the 2017 Oscars, the question of whether Best Picture would go to La La Land, a throwback musical that some criticize for white-splaining jazz, or Moonlight, seemed to have massive implications, as did the gaffe that initially gave the award to the former by mistake. White male heroes like John Wayne have given way to the clueless white male, who doesn't even realize how racist he is and is regularly made into television sport, as on Saturday Night Live. For tens of millions of white Americans today, mainstream popular culture displays an unchristian, minority-glorifying, LGBTQ America they can't and don't want to recognize as their country, an America that seems to exclude them, to treat them as the enemy. All this was roiling below the 2016 presidential campaign. As Van Jones put it on election night, Trump's victory was in part a white lash. Threatened in America. To state the obvious, whites are not the only group that feels threatened in America today. Indeed, for many minorities, the very idea that whites could feel threatened is disingenuous and infuriating. The whole premise of the Black Lives Matter movement is that our country is, and has been since its founding, built on unceasing violence, abuse, and terror against black Americans. That ours is a country where, as writer Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote in his Letter to My Son, black Americans are routinely murdered while going about the routine business of life. Choked to death for selling cigarettes, shot for seeking help, and shot down for browsing in a department store. Whites may feel threatened, but they do not face mass, disproportionate incarceration. As author and civil rights lawyer Michelle Alexander has observed, the United States imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. In Washington, D.C., an estimated 3 out of 4 young black men, and nearly all those in the poorest neighborhoods, can expect to serve time in prison. White parents in America do not live in fear, as many black parents do, that their children will be gunned down without cause by the police. Jim Crow may officially be over, but attempts to disenfranchise blacks continue. In 2016, a federal appellate court found that the North Carolina legislature had deliberately targeted black voters in its voter identification requirements, as well as in provisions restricting same-day registration out-of-precinct provisional voting, and early voting, provisions enacted only after the legislature had collected data on racial voting patterns. The restrictions, ruled the court, target African Americans with almost surgical precision. Similar measures were struck down in Texas. Daily life, as psychologist Beverly Tatum has shown, differs materially for people of color in America, starting at an early age. White 3-year-olds are never asked why their skin looks so dirty. Whites are generally not followed around in stores or asked for identification when no one else is questioned. They are not passed over by taxi drivers or subjected to constant media images of people who look like them in handcuffs. Whites do not have to see people react to them by clutching their purses and crossing the street, and are not regularly subjected to police brutality. "I hope none of them ask about my spring break," says the protagonist of Angie Thomas's best-selling novel, The Hate U Give. "They went to Taipei, the Bahamas, Harry Potter world. I stayed in the hood and saw a cop kill my friend." If many whites feel anxiety in today's America, many blacks feel an existential threat that seems never to end. Muslim Americans, too, feel threatened in today's United States. The day after the 2016 presidential election, Omar Aziz described in a New Republic essay how he and his Muslim American friends reacted to Trump's win. "We felt in the deepest chambers of our being that America had betrayed us, had repudiated who we were. In a matter of minutes, the shining city on the hill became an armed citadel determined to oppose our existence. As people who come from the edges of society, we know what the face of white terror looks like and what Trump's victory means for our future. There is no silver lining." Mexican Americans feel threatened. The president of their country swept to power with anti-Mexican rhetoric. Reports abound of indiscriminate raids and detentions by ICE agents, and many live in fear that they or someone they love will be rounded up and deported. Women in America, not all but many, feel threatened. They fear that overt sexism will not only be normalized, but made fashionable again in the name of anti-political correctness. They fear that America may be entering a new era of sexual predation, sexual harassment, and sexual assault. Gay and transgender Americans feel threatened. They fear that a new conservative Supreme Court will undo hard-fought gains and that they will be subject to renewed hostility, stigma, and discrimination. Progressives in general feel threatened, under siege by what they see as a white, male-dominated, reactionary administration intent on destroying their vision of a tolerant, open, multicultural America. Finally, even though they won, Trump supporters feel threatened, under constant vitriolic attack from liberal America. In a survey of Eastern Washington State residents, one small business owner who voted for Trump said, "Citizens can be afraid to speak out on real issues for fear of being called racist, homophobic, xenophobic, etc., when they are none of those things." Another said, "I saw a YouTube video from the University of Chicago where students and some educators had made a piñata of President Trump and were telling the children to hit it and knock it down, and when they did, the adults told them to rip it apart. What kind of message is that sending to young children?" And, in the words of a former Democrat who voted twice for Bill Clinton but for Trump in 2016, "I feel like we are in some kind of civil war right now. The Democratic Party has changed so much that I don't recognize it anymore. They are scarier to me than these Islamic terrorists." Thus, we find ourselves in an unprecedented moment of pervasive tribal anxiety. For 200 years, whites in America represented an undisputed, politically, economically, and culturally dominant majority. When a political tribe is so overwhelmingly dominant, it can persecute with impunity, but it can also be more generous. It can afford to be more universalist, more enlightened, more inclusive, like the WASP elites of the 1960s who opened up the Ivy League colleges to more Jews, blacks, and other minorities, in part because it seemed like the right thing to do. Today, no group in America feels comfortably dominant. Every group feels attacked, pitted against other groups, not just for jobs and spoils, but for the right to define the nation's identity. In these conditions, democracy devolves into zero-sum group competition, pure political tribalism. Identity politics, left and right. In a sense, American politics has always been identity politics. If we define identity politics broadly to include cultural and social movements based on group identities, then slavery and Jim Crow were forms of identity politics for white Americans, just as the suffragette movement at the turn of the 20th century was for women. Nevertheless, at different times in the past, both the American left and the American right have stood for group-transcending values. Neither does today. 50 years ago, the rhetoric of pro-civil rights, great society liberals was, in its dominant voices, expressly group-transcending, framed in the language of national unity and equal opportunity. Introducing the bill that eventually became the Civil Rights Act of 1964, John F. Kennedy famously said, "This is one country. It has become one country because all of us and all the people who came here had an equal chance to develop their talents. We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right, that your children cannot have the chance to develop whatever talents they have." In his most famous speech, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. proclaimed, "When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." While more radical of black power movements, led by activists like Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and the Nation of Islam's Elijah Muhammad, espoused a more overtly racial, pro-black, or even anti-white agenda, King's ideals, the ideals that captured the imagination and hearts of the public and led to real change, transcended group divides and called for an America in which skin color didn't matter. Leading liberal philosophical movements of that era were similarly group-blind and universalist in character. John Rawls's enormously influential A Theory of Justice, published in 1971, called on people to imagine themselves in an original position, behind a veil of ignorance, in which they could decide on their society's basic principles without regard to race, gender, religious affiliation, or wealth. At roughly the same time, the idea of universal human rights proliferated, advancing the dignity of every individual as the foundation of a just international order. As Will Kimlicka would later point out, the international human rights movement deliberately elevated individual rights as opposed to group rights. Rather than protecting vulnerable groups directly through special rights for the members of designated groups, cultural minorities would be protected indirectly by guaranteeing basic civil and political rights to all individuals, regardless of group membership. Thus, although the left was always concerned with the oppression of minorities and the rights of disadvantaged groups, the dominant ideals in this period tended to be group-blind, often cosmopolitan, with many calling for transcending not just ethnic, racial, and gender barriers, but national boundaries as well.